and welcome to Earth Heart Network Radio, the land-to-mouth food farm and garden edition that comes your way live every Tuesday at 1 p.m., where we are one at one. And what is the 5-4-3-2-1 countdown launch? Well, that is the global community that is living as Earth stewards, magnifying love. Yes, magnifying love. That's what Earth Heart is all about. And connecting ideas and issues and your passion and purpose. And what are you inspired to do to help make the world a better place? Every day, we're all on that same team of Earth stewards, doing our best, being aware. And on this show, we're focusing on that land-to-mouth connection, where we know what we're eating, not only knowing, but growing it ourselves, knowing who our farmers are, knowing all the ways that we can be building our local food communities and sustainable living and lifestyles. You know, it's exciting, and at the same time, there's always challenges. You know, we've got a lot of toxic things out there. And meanwhile, we've got companies stepping up and getting rid of some toxic products and taking good steps toward a safer world and protecting our wonderful pollinators and our soil and keeping that soil vibrantly alive so that we can grow that nutrient-dense food that keeps us healthy and awake and aware and able to do the things we want to do out there regarding, again, building sustainable communities. So great to be with you here, Lisa Almaraz, your host, and it is a wintry day. Yes, snow all over the mountains. We just went through Winter Storm Jonas, about 10 to 20 inches through the mountains, and I heard Amy Goodman on Democracy Now! Talk about the highest amount of snowfall being 40-something inches somewhere, and I thought, nope. I heard of a more intense snowfall that was up at Mount Mitchell, 66 inches up at Mount Mitchell. That is the highest point in the Blue Ridge Mountains, so you can figure why the mountains would get a lot more way up there. So, hope you're doing wonderfully this afternoon, making some progress on perhaps some new visions and ideas and goals for the year, and moving into midwinter time, halfway towards spring, coming right up. And we have progress happening on many fronts. As I was mentioning, companies who are getting rid of neonicotinoid products. We have commitments from Home Depot and different organizations to phase them out. But I think we need to go for a more urgent ban on Roundup and all of these poisons. There are better businesses to be in. First of all, those are unsustainable businesses. So whoever is in that, that can't be a sustainable business anyway, right? And business is supposed to make profit. So that's not a long-term sustainable profit margin to be in, is the business of killing everything because we want to be here, right? Life is good. It's a good thing to help support life. But congratulations and hats off to Aldi grocery stores. This is a major supermarket banning B-toxic pesticides in produce production. Thanks a lot for this story, Beyond Pesticides at beyondpesticides.org. We've got a ban going on from Aldi Süd, the German supermarket chain with stores in the United States. Yes, we have them in here in Asheville as well. They have become the first major European retailer to ban pesticides toxic to bees, including the neonicotinoids imidal cloprid, clothianidin, and thiamethoxam from fruits and vegetables produced for their stores. So great job, Aldi. I love hearing news like this. Aldi has requested suppliers comply at the earliest possible time. They're not saying maybe by 2018, Home Depot, Lowe's, Walmart. They're not saying that. What are they saying? They're saying as fast as possible. You know, this thing about building sustainable culture is more urgent than going to the moon was. It's more of a team spirit thing. It's affecting everyone's life. So, of course, we want to do these things as quickly as possible, make those transitions as fast as possible so we can keep our pollinators alive. We can't be selling things that kill those important parts of our food supply, the workers there, those bees that do all of that pollinating. So Aldi has requested they comply as early as possible in light of the growing pollinator crisis, and due to public pressure, retailers in Europe and the U.S., they're beginning to make the switch away from the B-toxic pesticides. Beginning January 1st, suppliers of fruits and vegetables to Aldi suppliers started to ensure that their cultivation practices don't include the 8 pesticides identified as toxic to bees. And they are more than a few mouthfuls, right? I said a few of them a moment ago. Thiamethoxam, chlorpyrifos, clothianidin, cypermethrin, deltamethrin, fipronil, imidacloprid, and sulfoxaflor. Okay, so this is a new requirement. Get those out of here, right? They don't even sound right. They just sound like a bunch of jumbled words together, and it spells poison, right? It spells poison for the bees and for us and for all of life. So we've just got to connect the dots. It's all connected. Thank you, Aldi, for making that connection. We've got new requirements there at Aldi. If you want to sell your stuff there, can't have all those toxins. According to a press release from Greenpeace, the chemicals are used on various commodities in Europe, and they're being phased out. Kohlrabi, herbs, Brussels sprouts, cabbage, cauliflower, and kale. Cybermethrin is used on leeks, head cabbage, and leguminous vegetables. Deltamethrin is used on cauliflower, peppers, eggplant, zucchini, cucumber, pea, lettuce, and more. Sulfoxaflor was recently granted regulatory approval in Europe despite calls and legal action to prohibit it. So Aldi is joining other European retailers to take a stand against bee toxic pesticides. The UK's largest garden retailers, yes, let's follow suit on this one, Home Depot. Home Base, B&Q, and Wix have already stopped selling neonicotinoids, class of pesticides. Yes, we know it is highly toxic to bees. Retailers are making the shift. It's time for you to make that shift every single time that you are in a store. Vote with those dollars and make sure you're choosing the retailers and letting your choices be known about why you're doing it, why you're supporting the organic, you know, store where you get the organic section maybe of a store even. As we move from soil, not oil, right? We've got the Soil Not Oil Coalition that I was telling you about. Go to soilnotoilcoalition.org and check it out. Dr. Vandana Shiva there, and a great global network of people working on regenerative, sustainable agricultural models, building soil, not burning up the oil and burning up the atmosphere, right? And releasing carbon, but sequestering carbon, growing more food, truly feeding communities, building the life in the soil, and actually building and feeding those communities as well, right, as the plants interact and we get those gardens going all over. But Soil Not Oil is doing great work, and I encourage you to learn more about that. It is rare that we find certain new strains of animals out there, but just a while ago, a few weeks ago, a genetically pure bison was found in Utah. And I just want to share this because, you know, researchers have confirmed that the Henry Mountains of southern Utah are home to a rare, genetically pure bison herd. The team included Utah State University scientists who analyzed tissue samples from the bison, Dr. Johan Dutois, professor of ecology and large mammal conservation at USU, took part in the research. He said that the herd is even more unique than other populations of bison that have not interbred with cattle. And this is from UPR.org, a very, very special case. The Henry Mountains bison is actually, in fact, the only population of bison in existence, which is now both genetically pure and is free of the disease brucellosis, and is free-ranging on public land, commingling with cattle, and is legally hunted, Dutois said. So we have this very unique population, which is one of a kind. And it's a large credit to the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources, the Bureau of Land Management, and local Henry Mountains Grazing Association. Over the years, they have worked together to conserve this resource. Now, they call it a resource, but, you know, let's look at it as an interconnected species here that is an important part of that ecosystem. Because what we're learning more and more about sustainable grazing and regenerative grazing methods is that we need those herds, those hooves on the ground, that deposit of manure. And we actually have a massive manure missing link right now because we've lost all our megafauna pretty much around the world and human development. There is a huge missing manure link, actually. People call it a poop shortfall. It's actually manure missing out there that is needed to build our soils. And we can do that through conscious stewardship of our herds and emulate some of these conservation methods that they've been utilizing out in Utah. And Dr. Dustin Ranglack, now at Montana State University, is the lead author of the study and said the herd could have impact on future bison conservation. I certainly hope so, and I hope that we can conserve more of the Great Plains for bison re-inhabitation. We've got to create wildlife corridors, right? Wildlife does not thrive in little chunks in between people. Wildlife thrives in corridors of interconnection. And as Dr. Ranglack said, now we have only 500,000 bison. But of those, only 20,000 are what we would consider to be truly wild bison. Now we have a third a free-ranging bison that is disease-free and doesn't show any introgression of cattle genes, Ringlach said. That actually makes the Henry Mountains bison, in a way, almost even more valuable than, you know, a lot of the different species that are all intermixing out there. The keeping that recognition of the truly wild bison, it leads us back to learning more about our other herds and what we can do to integrate more sustainable ranching and grazing methods. So because of that, they can represent a really important source for potential reintroduction projects that are trying to restore bison to a large portion of their native range. The Henry Mountains was transferred from Yellowstone National Park in the 1940s. So interesting there, and a bit of old America, right? Old Native America there. Great to see that bison still alive, and glad that there's people out there that have worked to conserve it. You know, we used to have a little mini mountain bison here in the Appalachian Mountains. And no, people did not work to conserve it effectively. Other people worked to kill them effectively, and they're gone. And I think it's a pretty sad statement. It's a lack of earth stewardship. I'm not proud to have to tell you that, but I wasn't here at the time, of course. This was in the 1800s. And we had a lot of other species that are gone here from people just hunting them out as well. Famous ones, like we talked about that bird last week. But, you know, we've got to be stewards of our native species and our creatures. And, you know, I'd be interested to know, and I should check. I should ask Dr. Frank King, because he's got a great, really great bison herd out there in Lester over here in Western North Carolina. And that is King Bio. Dr. King, he has collected different bisons specific based on their breed. And I'm wondering how much he knows about this. And if there is any kind of bison out there who is maybe related closely to that extinct one from here. I wonder if there is, and if there'd be a way to somehow breed that sort of back and be able to see more of what that bison was really like. I understand they were much more compact. They were able to navigate up and down these mountain valleys. And it's very interesting when you learn about species, and the species are coming and going, really, because we have so many ecological disasters based on our ill-fated attempts to interact with nature. And we have good progress, right? But then we have these projects, and one of them is in Florida. Thank you, technocracy.news, for this story about the Florida Green Project turned into eco-disaster. Yes, let's throw a bunch of old tires down under the ocean and try to say we're going to help the waters. Well, it didn't work that way. CBS Evening News actually reported that Fort Lauderdale found itself in an ecological disaster after a local government sponsored the dumping of millions of tires in the city's waters. In its broadcast last month, CBS said that used tires, originally intended to form artificial reefs for new fish, dispersed and created an untenable living space for the city's wildlife. So instead of helping, it was harming. And, you know, you can build earthships, right? I've learned about that. You can build earthships with used tires. You pack them really hard, apparently, with dirt, and you stack them up, and you can make houses out of them. But not coral reefs. I mean, how does, in the mind, you just go, okay, used tires equals coral reefs. No, it just doesn't. that canyon doesn't go from there to there, right? It doesn't connect. But basically, military and private boats just littered Fort Lauderdale's ocean floor with used tires after government officials sponsored a massive dumping project that ruined the ocean's habitat. It started as a way to get rid of tires clogging up landfills, and then up to 2 million tires bundled by metal clips were dumped and make an artificial reef, but it didn't work that way. You know, we've got to plan things out and emulate nature, right? Emulation of nature in our gardens, in our homes, maintaining balance as much as possible and being able to maybe do something just a little bit differently, but not think we're just going to, okay, let's just go dump all our tires and it's going to turn into a coral reef. I mean, really? Fort Lauderdale did it. It's amazing. Some of the things we do and some of the plans that we put together actually can work very well. The plan to help restore the monarch butterflies has been working wonderfully. They have much higher populations this year. Yes, I'm happy to announce last year was absolutely devastating. I had it on the show. It was just heartbreaking. I was so worried about them. And now the populations are recovering somewhat, but we've still got to be protecting and taking back the millions of acres of habitat that has been lost to our migrating monarch population. as well as our other pollinating populations, birds, all kinds of creatures in our ecosystem, bats, all of our pollinators. And I'm glad to see we're getting a little bit of movement in our national strategy to promote the health of honeybees and other pollinators. And we've got to really make it more urgent, I feel, in general, on this. But there is a national plan. We talked about it before, and it's out there. And it calls for a lot of possible things, but those things aren't happening yet. Like, for instance, altering mowing schedules. One of the things I read in there, and it's always bothered me, when you see a ton of beautiful wildflowers and all of a sudden they're mowing them all, right in the middle of all the bees trying to have food and enjoy the flowers. And I actually have jumped out of my car on more than one occasion and asked them to please avoid certain ones and stuff, and they did. It was great, but yet, you know, I found out more. I talked to him, actually, and found out more about the mowing thing. But, you know, there's regional directors for the mowing schedule. And apparently, we can be changing this. But I know even though that plan was still floating last mowing season, all the mowing schedules were still going. Why? Because people have contracts and they push ahead to do it. But we've got to really take action in on all the fronts of this national plan. And, you know, there's a lot of details. The plan envisions reducing honeybee loss 15% in 10 years. I think we can do a lot better banning all these poisons that are killing our pollinators to begin with. We can get way more than 15% just like that very quickly. That on top of taking action in powerful ways. We're looking at adding 7 million acres in this plan of wildflower habitat by 2020. I love this. Okay, I love this part. 7 million acres of wildflower habitat. That's like a dream to me. But I think we need more and make sure they're in corridors, not just isolated, right? We've got to have it where the butterflies don't have to go across massive freeways and things like that. We've got to have our corridors in place, wildlife corridors, okay? We're looking at this plan, calling all hands on deck, you know, we're really looking at engaging a lot of communities, all the many different federal agencies, state and local governments, universities, nonprofit groups, and citizens, to really basically saying raise the sails, especially since everyone needs to opt in and get through the national strategy to promote the health of honeybees and other pollinators. This is the Pollinator Research Action Plan. Find out more. It's important this document even exists. It's great to see. Christian Krupke, Associate Professor of Entomology at Purdue University, is very happy to see this commitment to huge, ambitious goals. She thinks it's a strong document. Lots of people are very heartened by this, but it's going to take the work. It's going to take the work, and it's going to be little changes over time to help rebuild our bee populations and stop the losses. There's a lot of big ifs over the whole strategy. There's onward gaps that we've got to be meeting, but we've got to come together and help the honeybees and the other pollinators, and we can do it. I am confident. You know, I have watched the magic of a garden in a season. You know, I put stuff out there, stuff I didn't even know I put out there sometimes grows, and all of a sudden, I had the only flowers around here the other day when it was unseasonably warm on Christmas, and all the bees were there, every kind of bee you could imagine. And those bees, I know, are supporting the rest of the ecosystem, and I was so happy I was able to support in my own small way. And if we do it to the tunes of millions of acres and we start growing and covering our ground and sequestering more carbon and changing the entire quality of air and really doing the powerful things that we know we can do, supporting our honeybees and other pollinators in a whole buffer system for habitats, we can make tremendous progress. And I'm very, very confident of that. It's just keeping up with these day-to-day goals and bringing them into reality. And I'm so proud of all the teams of people that are doing that. And I have to look more in depth on top of the mowing schedule thing, because to me, that's a real key part of that plan that could help in many ways. So there are some interesting things. You know, we all choose to take action on different issues, depending on what we're passionate about, maybe depending on a personal experience that has moved us to need to do something about an issue that is deeply affected us in some way. And, you know, it's interesting because we've got people out there, you know, living from their heart and doing it. And then they end up sometimes even being targeted by organizations that don't want the information out there. And even kids, teenagers I was so amazed to see the story by Allison Vukcinich from globalnews.ca about documents revealing a Canadian teenager was actually the target of a GMO lobby. And at the time, Rachel Parent was 14 years old. She had a growing social media following. Her message to label GMOs in food was attracting attention, including from those who promote GMOs in the United States. Their internal emails revealed they were discussing how they could counter her message. And a little, you know, a kid writing a letter, right? The most basic little form of, hey, please do this, you know, please label the food. It's just a kid asking for a label. And all of a sudden, the kid is being thwarted on social media by people that are being paid to, you know, put out disinformation on a teenager. I mean, can't we be doing something more useful with our time? Can't we be building good, sustainable models instead of trying to quiet a teenager? I mean, you know, I mean, it just seems so silly. But basically, it was uncovered and, you know, the transparency, you just have to look out there. It's just a kid who is being an activist. She's speaking out about wanting the labels of GMOs on there. And she's got a Kids Right to Know little website, and she's very articulate. And then she, you know, she finds out that she's being targeted. You know, it's just ironic because, you know what? The unsustainable models are not good for anybody. And the experiments that we do out there in reality that are not good for anyone, aren't good for the dolphins, aren't good for, you know, the Maui Popoto, the world's rarest and smallest known species of sub-dolphin. We've got, you know, these tests going on. We've got marine reserves being explored for oil exploration with seismic testing, basically blowing up bombs and killing millions of creatures, as well as military tests we've got slated. Petroleum exploration for a long time. We've already had tons of animals die. And, you know, we think it's okay somehow. And we can't even afford to burn the oil in the atmosphere. You know, we're air-breathing mammals. And yet we're killing other air-breathing mammals to burn up our atmosphere, explore the possibility of getting more oil to do that. You know, it's beyond insane. We've got to really get a hold of ourselves here and ban this kind of destructive testing that goes on, because what are we really getting out of it? It's not helping us. It's just helping us figure out how to undo ourselves even more. We don't need that kind of help. We need help bringing ourselves together even more is what is required. And that is what our job is, and coming together and realizing that every single time that we allow poison into our environment, it's affecting our soil, our water, our health. And you know, glyphosate is now being found to really damage DNA. And glyphosate in Roundup, which we have called to ban that, and we've got the petition out there. You can check out, look up the petition to ban Roundup to President Obama to please immediately ban that. It is the most dispersed poison, and it's considered the most toxic substance out there, and it's the most dispersed. And we're just finding out about the depth and breadth of the damages it causes. We have been misinformed for 40 years on this product and this substance, told that it was only affecting the plant enzymes, which is not in fact true. It actually seriously affects the red blood cells of mammalian red blood cells of humans and anybody else who has red blood cells. That's a mammal. And glyphosate damages our DNA. And this is now coming from a World Health Organization expert, you know, Chris Portier, co-author of a report by World Health Organization's Cancer Agency, which classed glyphosate as a probable carcinogen. You know, he's talking about the DNA. Genotoxic, okay? Regulators for genotoxic chemicals. Genotoxic means it damages the DNA. And these are also carcinogenic chemicals. And so we have these multiple effects and layers of toxicity here. And there was a briefing with Dr. Robin Mesnage of the Department of Medical and Molecular Genetics at King's College in London, presenting data showing Roundup is 1,000 times more toxic than glyphosate alone. So we've got glyphosate in our entire food chain and our water, and even in unborn children's amniotic fluid. The lack of toxicity of data on toxicity of glyphosate isn't proof of safety, and a lot of the data we're finding has been hidden, and that now we're starting to uncover. And Roundup, the commercial name of glyphosate-based herbicides, contains many other chemicals which mixed together are 1,000 times more toxic than glyphosate on its own. How much? We don't need it to get any worse. We don't. We can go ahead and ban this stuff, right? It only makes sense. And check out places like GMWatch.org and organizations. Claire Robinson, there, an editor, said some retailers in Switzerland and Germany have removed the glyphosate products from their shelves. And I'm so happy to hear France has committed to stop selling them to consumers via self-service by 2018. Now, again, we've got, I think, too long on some of these decisions. I think you've got to go more quickly on this. Peter Melchett, Soil Association Policy Director, said if glyphosate ends up in bread, it's impossible for people to avoid it unless they are eating organic. Okay. On the other hand, farmers could easily choose not to use glyphosate as a spray on wheat crops just before they are harvested. This is a common practice as a desiccant to dry it out to make it easier to harvest. That is why the Soil Association is calling for the immediate ending of the use of glyphosate sprays on wheat destined for use in bread. And that is usually why people think they're gluten intolerant, because they're glyphosate intolerant. They're eating it on the wheat that isn't organic, and they're getting terribly irritated from it and toxified. And that is not gluten intolerance. It is glyphosate intolerance. And of course, we don't do certain things to our bread to help us digest it as we have done. Good old-fashioned, nice bread, sprouted grains, things like that. Good process of fermentation and really being able to help break down some of that bread before we eat it is great. But, you know, sometimes we go fast. We get the chemicals in there and this toxic wheat is in there. And it's not good for people, and they don't feel well with it. And, oh, I'm gluten intolerant. All of a sudden, the whole world's gluten intolerant, you know, which is, you know, obviously not the case. And there have been many, many cases of people stopping the non-organic wheat sources in their diet, and next thing you know, they suddenly aren't gluten intolerant anymore when they're eating organic food. So great to see that. And, you know, these things just need to be banned, honestly. And I just want to, you know, continue to highlight the many, many compelling reasons. I mean, there is just absolutely no question that this does not belong out there in to the millions and millions of gallons and millions of acres and on food that people eat, when we know what we know at this point. And, you know, when we have the great resources of nature all around us, it's wise to protect them. You know, and we've still got some fantastic forests in this world. And yet, we've got plans to log them. Oh, we want to log the Valley's ancient forest in central Waalbronn, there in Surrey and Vancouver, British Columbia. They're trying to extend an injunction against the Wilderness Committee and other activists working to protect old-growth forests in the Waalbronn Valley. Since November, independent activists have blocked several Teal Jones logging operations in the Waalbronn. They are asking the court to renew injunction there, the logging company. It had expired, and aiming to restrict public access to the area for the next 9 months. It's really, you know, the real front of where people are trying to protect the forests out there is real. And there are only so many left of old-growth forests, and they are irreplaceable. They are the last of their kind. There is no replacement for old-growth forests. When I see pictures of the ancient Appalachian forest, the oldest pictures that exist of the uncut old-growth, it is so breathtaking. There are no trees that you see that are that big anymore. The only trees that were the biggest that I've seen that way were up in Joyce Kilmer Memorial Forest, and many of those trees are dying now because of a lot of pollution issues. But we just don't have old-growth forest able to be replaced. We can't replace it. We have to preserve it, protect it, and then work on helping it thrive and reestablish itself. You know, there are people out there working to try to protect these places. Today, the Central Waalbronn represents some of the finest of the last 4% that is needed to protect, pointing out Ancient Forest Alliance campaigner T.J. Watt. You know, business group is calling to halt for old-growth logging. There are people saying, let's stop this stuff, you know, and it's unmatched for tourism appeal. I mean, you want to go and see an old-growth forest without disturbing it and just respectfully go there. It is the most healing, wonderful, ancient, alive, absolutely soul-sustaining place. and it is an asset in every way. And there are so many things that we haven't even discovered about the forest. Why chop them all down first? We need to go ahead and learn and respect and protect and preserve. And we have some opportunities to do that. We have some opportunities to do that. And there are about 30 million acres around the world that are slated to be logged in the next years. We need to stop all of that. To me, it's just got to stop. We've got to find other ways. There's other things out there. There's quinoa. There's hemp. There's all kinds of things that grow. There's bamboo that are quick and that do not need for us to destroy our forests. And we've got to quit making excuses for industries that are just ecocidal industries. They're just not going to sustain life on Earth. It's just life is sustained through forests, through healthy oceans, through ecosystems, habitats, and we're part of that. And that's the beauty and magic of life, right? Seeing a dolphin jump out of the ocean, watching a whale go with its newborn calf, seeing a monarch fly by, watching a hummingbird drink nectar. These are the magical moments of life that are uplifting and inspiring and worth protecting and preserving and taking care of and uplifting and making way for, you know, making way for monarchs, making way for all of the creatures out there that we celebrate life with. So great to see that we've got all of these wonderful things that we can do, ways we can interact with our community. One of the fun things you can do in the winter is shop for seeds, maybe collect seeds, get together seeds that you want to share with others. And thanks to Chris Parker, our mushroom fun guy here in Asheville. He's got the Asheville Fun Guy mushroom place there and grows all kinds of wonderful fungus that you can eat, very delicious culinary mushrooms. Chris Parker just started a non-GMO seed swap here in Asheville. And I encourage you, start something like that. Start a non-GMO seed swap or make some seed balls. Make some organic seed balls that you can give to children to throw out in their garden for wildflowers to help support pollinators. We can get more flowers growing, more oxygen being produced, more carbon being sequestered in gardens all over every little corner out there, and really look at changing the dynamics in our society. And it's really important to be able to do that and inspire children, especially because children, you know, that's the future. And when a child is already connected to their food and how it's grown and what it looks like when it's growing and planting that seed and watching it sprout, that is a deep life skill that will help sustain that child. You know, when you eat, you, I think, also should know how to grow food, right? If we eat, we need to be able to grow gardens and keep those abundant gardens growing for fresh food right there available to us, even just sprouts, whatever it is. You know, and one of the things that's getting more and more attention these days is coconut oil. And just so you are aware that the coconut oil is so good for us, and there are many ways to integrate that. I would encourage you to look into that as one little healthy new thing to do in your diet for the new year. Sometimes it's just one little thing at a time tweaks us in the perfectly right direction, and we start to make great progress, and even just through those small refinements that we start to make, and those little commitments, that 5 extra minutes to do something consciously is all it takes to change our life. And we start to value that quality of life as we make those changes. And someone out there who is promoting great quality of life and good food and being aware is Michael Pollan. And he's got In Defense of Food, a look behind the scenes of this new film. You can check it out. It's online. It's been a few years since Food Inc. came out, and author Michael Pollan last graced the big screen. And on just there at the end of December, you can check out his wisdom again. He is there on PBS, In Defense of Food. This is a documentary film based on his book of the same name. So he does a documentary and a book. Goes together well. If you want to get inspired about food and fun and awareness and getting out there and knowing what you're doing with food, Michael Pollan, great new film there to go with the book. And, you know, in the new year, it's always great to pick a new book. Pick something up every week or two, something in a direction that's going to expand the different aspects of our awareness. You know, we get sometimes focused on one aspect of looking at things. And if we turn that around and we say, oh, you know, here's another way of looking at something. And we open up a book and it does just that, right? Some author has a whole take on something that just expands our awareness exponentially in some new way, and it sheds light in some other part of our life. So I encourage you to do that. Michael Pollan, of course, a great author. Well, the disaster there at Porter Ranch out there spewing ginormous amounts of methane, of course, ginormous, not an actual word, but it's hundreds of millions of pounds of natural gas being spewed in a community there in L.A. County. People getting out of there, evacuating, feeling awful, getting sick. Southern California Gas owns a facility distributing gas to 14 power plants and 21 million customers. And that storage field in Aliso Canyon is blowing. It's called the worst environmental disaster since the BP oil spill. Well, there are hundreds of facilities. There are many, many facilities like this around the country. Many. And now people that live under them or that live above them are realizing, wow, these old wells aren't very maintained, are they? And maybe there's some regulatory loopholes going on that make it unmanageable. Just like the BP oil spill, you know, the deep sleeve and the collar and the way it was broken and all that, and they couldn't fix it. It was neglected. And we get these unprecedented catastrophes, and somebody was making money the whole time and not doing their job. We can't have that kind of business going on, right? It's certainly not sustainable for the business or the world. But yes, that's still going on. Just want to mention that. They're still trying to get that under control. It's been weeks and weeks already. Over a month and a half going on. Los Angeles County. You would not think this kind of thing could happen in Los Angeles, right? Oh, yeah. It's happening, and they are still fumbling to try to get it under control. The local impact has been severe. About 30,000 people live in Porter Ranch, a bedroom community of gated developments, 4,000 square foot homes that sell for about $1 million or more. The neighborhood offers good schools, used to offer clean air, and a sense of security. Well, until now, all of that has been disrupted. Many residents have experienced headaches, nosebleeds, nausea, other symptoms. Sounds like a pharmaceutical drug commercial, doesn't it? Some 2,000 families have been moved. Now that number has increased. They've gone to hotels or short-term rentals to escape the gas. People get up, oh, I don't feel so good. Should I stay? Should I stay? Are you kidding? Get out of there. Get out of there. No way, right? Of course you shouldn't stay there. If you're living next to a toxic thing, of course you shouldn't stay there. I've seen so many documentaries with people. One that really touched me was in my hometown of Corpus Christi, Texas, and there was the Koch brothers' own chemical plant spewing all this stuff, and these people were living right next to it. And dying of all these horrible diseases. And sitting there while their families slowly got sick and died as they took care of them sick and dying. And they're sitting there with a car in the driveway. And I'm thinking, get in that car and get out of there. You know, get away from toxic stuff, right? Like the people in Flint, Michigan. If I was living there, I don't know how I would do it. But I would get out of there. You know, I would not be sitting there exposing myself to that water. And I don't know. I mean, one case of water a day. And then all the people that are immigrants don't want to open the door because they think they're going to get in trouble. And people are all sitting there with this water in their home. The kids are still bathing in it. I'm listening to the mom on the radio, and they're saying, oh, my gosh, what if my child drank that water accidentally in the bathtub? In the bathtub? What is the kid doing in the bathtub? Why are you even taking a bath? Oh, because we don't have anything else. Well, you know what? I would do anything else. I would drive to the next town, something. Right? We've got to take action. You know, sitting there like zombies and going, wow, what? I'm so sick. I mean, well, of course you're sick. You know, of course the world, of course we're going to make ourselves sick if we keep doing this. So that's why we've got to do something differently, right? And do it quickly and make it urgent and go ahead and make those changes and make the rules tighter on these industries that are out there ready to blow and toxify the whole environment, like this gas well out there in Porter Ranch. What went wrong? Well, it's just another little ecocidal time bomb ticking, waiting to blow. And there are many of these storage facilities, many of them. So we've got to get ahead of ourselves on this one and get those things inspected and fortified and modified and made manageable. Because right now, it's pretty unmanageable. And they're saying it's like adding millions and millions of cars to the road every day. So 7 or 8, 7 million cars or something. I've added like 10 million by now, 20 million. All this is like adding extra cars when you look at this gas leak. You can't see it with a normal naked eye. You can only see it with infrared. Looks like a giant black cloud coming out of the landscape there. They're trying to kill this well, but this thing goes down to 8,000 feet. 8,000 feet. It's amazing. And then that's where the reservoir is at, down at 8,000 feet. It's a big job. It's a big job. And here's to the very best of getting that under control, guys and ladies out there working. I know they're having a very challenging time because the whole place could ignite. The whole thing is combustible, right? This whole natural gas leak is combustible. So any little spark, anything trying to work out there, extra tough. I'm sure those families are praying around the clock for those crews that are out there working because it's in a very, very dangerous situation to be working in. Well, it is the Land-to-Mouth Food, Farm, and Garden edition of Earth Heart Network Radio. Great to be with you. Lisa Almaraz, your host and producer. Wonderful to share information that we've got to be aware so we can take action, right? We've got to be aware and do things. Plant those seeds. You know, I encourage you to watch more videos on livingwebfarms.org and learn how to get your seeds started for your upcoming garden. Learn how to graft a tomato. We've got a short video on that, and we're going to have a class on that this evening. Learn how to ferment vegetables. Learn how to build life in the soil. All these things are available, and when we take action on them, we build that sustainable world that we dream about. It's right now. It's every little thing we do, and having fun in the meantime, and being aware. And there's some new little gadgets out there to help us be aware. Sometimes it's fun. Sometimes, of course, you've got to start with at least reading the labels, right, on what you're eating. Yeah, you've got to start and not just reading the label, but actually knowing what those words mean. If you're reading a word like disodium sulfate or something, and you don't know what that means, it's useless, right? It's not going to help you. You need to know what the words are too. But there's a little gadget now, and it will actually scan your food and reveal nutritional value. I was telling you about this last year. And now it is out there. Yes, this little gadget can tell you how many carbs, how many calories are on your dinner plate. It promises to reveal the nutritional value of a meal by scanning its chemical makeup. French startup Diet Sensor launched at the 2016 International Consumer Electronics Show, a pocket-sized Bluetooth-connected molecular sensor called SIO. It uses near-infrared spectroscopy, the analysis of how molecules are interacting with light, to determine the chemical makeup of foods and drinks. SIO, or SO, I don't know how they're saying it, but it can analyze substances based on their molecules. And it may sound like a very interesting tool, but it's primarily aimed at helping people with conditions like diabetes or cardiovascular diseases. They want to keep a close eye on their diet. In a demo, the scanner was held over a piece of cheese. After one click of a button, the corresponding app revealed the fat content, carbs, and related tips. In other words, you shouldn't exceed more than 54 grams of this type of product in a given time period. Interesting. Scanning food now with spectroscopy for nutritional intake, it is out there. The gadget is out there. SIO, yes, it's a little food zapper. It doesn't do anything. It just reads those molecules. Founders Remy and Astrid Bonas came up with the concept in 2014 when their 9-year-old daughter was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, which required her to monitor the carbohydrate intake of each meal and measure insulin. And ultimately, they developed a nutrition coaching app and worked with another company for a gadget that uses science to automate the process. The concept uses spectroscopy, which highlights how food molecules in food vibrate in a unique manner when it interacts with light. While this method has been used in science labs before, the Diet Sensor brings it to consumers for the first time from this company, and it can only read homogeneous foods such as cheese, crackers, bread. It wouldn't be able to pick up all of the ingredients in a sandwich, of course, you know, just reading there on the surface. You'd have to do things more individually to get that more complex picture. It can work on homemade food as well. A piece of cake, you can scan that. Of course, it's not going to scan for things like pesticides or glyphosate or anything like that. So just choose organic, and very interesting. A little gadget for scanning food. The SkyOS scanner is available for $249, and the app is free but requires a fee. So interesting there. The new SIO little gadget to scan food for nutritional value. Just one other little tool at your disposal. But, of course, nutritional value is going to depend on how good the soil was. And how good the soil is how wonderful that farm is with that organic greenhouse or that organic field out there. So it all goes back to the soil. And that's where our ingredients are coming from. And when we've got genetically modified things coming from genetically modified plants and poisoned soils with pesticides, then that's going to affect that nutritional value and how we're metabolizing it and how our health is affected as well. And it's great to see, you know, us coming around the block on some of these things. Right now, one of the new things that has just happened is Hershey. The Hershey company is dumping sugar beets because of the genetically modified organism concerns that are out there. You know, the entire sugar beet industry pretty much turned GMO over the last years. And it has been pervading a lot of things as a sweetener. It's out there in many different products. But Hershey has decided they're not going to put any more sugar that is made in Minnesota from these sugar beets. For decades, the Hershey company has used sugar made from both sugar beets and sugar cane, but it decided earlier this year to stop buying beet sugar because it comes from genetically modified seeds that some consumers don't like. Hershey, with 2014 sales of $7.4 billion and more than 80 brands of candy sold around the world, was a huge customer for beet sugar farmers, and its decision was significant enough to be noted earlier this month at two annual shareholder meetings of sugar beet cooperatives. So when a company makes a powerful choice like, hey, we don't want any more sugar beets from genetically modified sugar beets, you know what? It sends seismic tectonic waves through the markets, through these sugar beet cooperatives. They're like, whoa, 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 wait a minute. We just lost a massive, massive client sale. So that's a big deal. I'm glad to see it. I'm proud of Hershey for this. I want them to, of course, do things more that are organic, of course, if you can. And I know we've got some threats going on to the cacao, the chocolate that's grown around the world because of climate change as well. We've got all kinds of things that need help out there. So Hershey is committed to bringing us great chocolate. I hope they can help with some of that. I know it's very threatened in the next decade or two because of drying conditions and extreme weather that's going on. But Hershey has made a difference. David Berg, president and CEO of American Crystal Sugar in Moorhead, Minnesota, the nation's largest sugar beet co-op, told members gathered in their Fargo, North Dakota meeting that the anti-GM movement is one of the industry's biggest challenges. And Kurt Wickstrom, president and CEO of MinDAC Farmers Cooperative in Wahpeton, North Dakota, said the anti-GM groups are a real threat whose claims need to be countered. Well, how about we get good food? And we don't have genetically modified things that have to force us to use a bunch of chemicals and poison the soil. You know, we don't want that. We need to have things that are sustainable and long-term. Hershey Communications Director Jeff Beckman confirmed that the Hershey's Kisses and many other products stocked on shelves since Halloween no longer contain beet sugar. The company also is transitioning away from artificial to natural ingredients, he said. More than three-quarters of the sugar they're using today is cane sugar, which is not genetically modified, he said. And as we get into our into 2016, the expectation is to be at or near 100% to use just cane sugar and not any beet sugars from genetically modified beets. No matter how or where the company sources the sugar, it's still just going to say sugar on the product, but they have made the commitment that they are not going to have the genetically modified source any longer. Minnesota is the top sugar beet producer in the nation, followed by Idaho and North Dakota. And industry officials would not disclose how much of their sugar is sold to candy companies. About 55% of domestic U.S. sugar is produced from sugar beets, and nearly 100% of the beet seeds are genetically modified to tolerate the herbicide glyphosate, the active ingredient in Roundup. So we've got the beets out there made to be able to spray a ton of poison on them and still survive, and then that's somehow going to be okay to eat. No, right? As we already said, that's got to be banned. But it's great to see Hershey making this fantastic move and going for it. Really just saying, no, we're not going to have it in there. And it's really great because there is headway happening. There's headway happening, and companies are making changes, and coalitions are forming to help get rid of this toxic food. We know about glyphosate. If this is made to withstand that, then that's got glyphosate as well. We don't want all these layers of toxins anymore. We've got to have layers of wellness, layers of healing, layers of things that build life and sustain us long term. And it's really important that we take that chance every time we have an opportunity. Every time we have an opportunity to make that better choice, to maybe reach out, to help someone else make a better choice, to plant another garden, plant another seed, even if it's a seed of inspiration for someone else, that we take that opportunity. Because every step in the right direction counts. And sometimes people just need a little inspiration. And there's some wild new inventions out there. There's some forward-thinking architecture. Actually, a group of forward-thinking architecture has designed a set of modular floating farms to actually desalinate saltwater, harvest rainwater and sunlight, and grow thousands of tons of vegetables a year. These things are as big as 200 by 350 meters, rectangular units. They're inspired by Chinese floating fish farms. They can be connected to each other by walkways and grow tons of food. And these units are being built. These things are coming together. There's so many inspiring ideas out there that are super innovative things that are happening already. Things that we can be plugging in a bigger way, in communities all over. We've got to be able to plug in the innovations and unplug the anachronistic, ecocidal things that are causing all the problems. You know, when we unplug the source of problems and we plug in more fantastic solutions and ideas and innovations, wow, the changes can just exponentialize. The synergy can come together and the changes are exponential, and we can make a huge difference by doing that. Stay inspired, live your passion and purpose, and do your best today to just make that one small step. We'll talk to you next week right here on Earth Heart Network Radio.